previously on Accused.
But did you talk to Charlie about anything?
Dad was supervisor when Dave Box disappeared.
When you finished recording, you may hang up or...
I'd left a message fairly recently, returning a call I had gotten from this number.
Hi, I'm Amber. I'm a reporter with the Enquirer. I've been trying to reach Charlie Schaus.
At the tone, please record your message. When you finished recording, you may hang up.
Do you know that in some of the trials, it is accepted as fact that you did think he was depressed?
No, I don't think he was.
I'm Amber Hunt, and this is Accused, the mysterious death of David Box. A month after David Box vanished while working at the Fernald Uranium Processing Plant, he was officially fired from his job there. It was a bit of housekeeping, really, to allow the company to clear out the two lockers he'd had on the property. They inventoried the belongings he'd left behind, the long-sleeve t-shirt and cut-off jean shorts that he'd been wearing earlier in the day, his wallet, a white hairbrush, size 10 gym shoes, a pair of black socks, an empty red and white Playmate cooler, 65 cents in change. All that remained of David were things. His kids divvied up these belongings, as well as the ones pulled from the house he had inherited from his parents that would soon be reclaimed by the bank. With no body to bury and no answers to why their lives had been upended so suddenly, they tried to plot on.
I never forget about my dad. I think about him every day. I told you I have his baseball mitt from when he was a kid on the dashboard of my truck. I look at it as I'm driving down the road. I see it every day.
The Box kids were forced to face their grief, and as news of Fernald's safety issues surfaced and the plant's closing drew nearer, their hopes of learning what happened to David scattered like so much uranium dust. In this episode, we'll do our best to wrap up two stories, the plants and our investigations.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
As the 1990s neared, it was clear the more than 40-year Cold War was coming to an end. President Ronald Reagan had used the 80s to ramp up the U.S.'s nuclear warhead efforts in the hopes of, more or less, intimidating the USSR and its allies. As a satellite state of the Soviet Union, East Germany was one of those allies. East and West Germany had been divided since 1961 by a literal wall that snaked through Berlin. Mikhail Gorbachev was the general secretary of the Communist Party, and as the 1980s wore on, he loosened restrictions on free speech. Not everyone was thrilled with his push for openness between the people and the government, but then came the Chernobyl disaster of 1986. As writer Craig Mazin emphasized in his recent HBO series, Chernobyl was about more than an explosion at a nuclear plant. It was about a governmental cover-up.
What is the cost of lies?
Gorbachev had initially been fed misinformation about the scale of the disaster. It was tough for him to reconcile this obvious cover-up attempt with his outward call for openness, and historians generally consider the disaster to be a turning point for the General Secretary. Then, in June 1987, Reagan gave his famous speech calling for,
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Unlike some of his predecessors, Gorbachev didn't have much faith that the USSR could win the arms race and he wasn't a fan of the prospect of nuclear war anyway. His citizens became increasingly emboldened to protest the Berlin Wall, and on December 22, 1989, a gate was opened allowing people to pass through for the first time in nearly 30 years. The wall officially fell in November 1991. Nothing happens in a vacuum. All of this world news had big impact on the livelihoods of Fernald's workers and on the 14,000-some residents who live near the Fernald plant. With the Cold War winding down, production slowed. With the controversies about uranium leaks at their zenith, Fernald was especially vulnerable because lawsuits cost money. The plant was producing less, thus making less money, thus destined to collapse. Not that workers didn't fight the inevitable. Lisa Crawford, who helped launch the community organization Fresh, remembers that the workers were not fans of her or her class action lawsuit.
Because, you know, it's jobs. It's, you know, you're messing with my retirement. And there were threats around here that they keep it up, nobody will have a job. And they kind of used that as leverage. And they didn't like us at all.
That began to change as more and more evidence surfaced to substantiate the rumors of long-term radioactive leaks. In October 1988, the workers went on strike over pay and benefits. Lisa Crawford brought coffee and donuts to the picket line, and the two sides started to mend fences. About this time, Richard Schenck, director of the Ohio Environmental Protection Agency, compiled statistics documenting an extremely serious environmental threat dating back to the plant's opening. This from a 1988 article in the Chicago Tribune. Quote, "Waste from a total of 298,000 pounds of uranium has been discharged into the air since the plant began operating in 1951, Schenck said, and waste from 167,000 pounds of uranium was discharged into the Great Miami River nearby. He said the underground water table had been subjected to unknown amounts of radiation leaked from six storage pits at the site. Those pits hold about 12.7 million pounds of uranium and 176,000 pounds of thorium." End quote. Interesting tidbit. Not much thorium metal was made at Fernald, yet massive amounts of it were stored in silos on the site. That's because Fernald wasn't just a uranium processing plant. It was also a dump site for other nuclear facilities, particularly those situated on the East and West coasts. The U.S. government decided that Middle America would be a smarter storage spot for such waste because the coasts were more at risk of being bombed by another country making scary weapons, and you wouldn't want a silo of radioactive material struck by an enemy. So, waste from the Manhattan Project, that's the name of the World War II project that produced the first nuclear weapons, actually was stored at Fernald, and neighbors didn't know it.
So they had tons and tons of debris that was radioactive that was never generated from Fernald.
This is lawyer Stan Chesley being interviewed for the Living History Project in 1999.
For example, you saw, it looked like erector sets out there. It was quite phenomenal, and there were metal materials. It was a junkyard. Think in terms of a giant radioactive junkyard over and above the barrels and the containers and so, but they were, for example, storing thorium in a Quonset hut that was leaking, and most of that thorium had never been used at Fernald. The K-65 silos are another example. They were acting as a storage facility. I was always reminded when we were in court, they kept saying, well, we can't move it because it's too dangerous. And I said, well, it was just as dangerous when you brought it. It did not get there by metamorphosis. You know, it didn't just all of a sudden appear. It wasn't placed in those tanks. And the way they were curing the problem was they were building an earthen dam around the tanks. Well, so it was leaking into the dirt.
Lisa Crawford, the community activist, remembered learning that some of the waste had traveled all the way from the Belgian Congo.
But the reason it was sent here to us was because so the U.S. could put Pershing missiles in the Belgian Congo. You know, the average Joe around here is going, God, really?
It was a giant mess, one far greater than workers or residents ever could have imagined. And it probably wouldn't have come to light if it hadn't been for the lawsuits, which weren't easy to pull off, by the way. Chesley didn't sue the Department of Energy because he figured they'd claim governmental immunity. He targeted the contractors instead. And it turned out that the contractors back in the 50s, when these plants arose nationwide, refused to do this type of work unless they were indemnified. The federal government needed contractors, so they agreed to the demand.
They, the federal government, gave NLO, which was a subsidiary of National Lead, not only an indemnity for day-to-day activities of the dangerous nature, but for any negligence. Have you ever heard of the government giving a indemnity for negligence and punitive conduct? And what that was a license to National Lead not to worry, that the government would indemnify and the government would hold them harmless. And that the problem was National Lead and all of these companies that took over these nuclear weapons plants had absolutely no expertise in nuclear energy. It was the 50s. Had no idea what was about, how to do it. Safety was not a factor. Nobody understood it.
The Ohio Environmental Protection Agency, whose involvement started when they sent Graham Mitchell to do some well testing a few months after David Box disappeared, was publicly angry that the federal government did so shoddy a job running this plant. Governor Richard Celeste accused the feds of, quote, deceit and mismanagement, end quote, and called on President Reagan to shut down Fernald. It was a bold demand, but not the first of its kind. A South Carolina plant at Savannah River that produced tritium had recently shut down three reactors, while a third facility, the Rocky Flats plant in Colorado, which handled plutonium, had been temporarily closed because of safety complaints. It stopped production permanently in 1989. Fernald workers, who, remember, were making good livings at the plant and who believed in its mission, went on strike but didn't want the plant to shutter. Many, represented by the union, were furious. They felt betrayed. But they didn't want to lose their jobs. They wanted the problems fixed. Instead, production stopped. That might have happened without the bad publicity and the lawsuits. The Cold War ended in 1991, after all. But Chesley credits both with ensuring that the DOE didn't just abandon 1,000 acres of polluted land.
Frankly, had there not been this lawsuit, they might have sold the land and people could have built houses on it. Nobody knew. Nobody really knew. You know, people criticized the legal system. The legal system brought it out.
After the DOE reached a settlement with residents, workers sued. That, too, was settled for $100 million. Here's TV coverage from WCPO, a Cincinnati station.
Today's Fernald settlement is designed to make sure workers and former workers like Kelly get some help. It calls for lifetime medical monitoring, government-paid for yearly medical exams for eligible Fernald workers and former workers for as long as they live.
Community members, particularly those involved with Fresh, the group Lisa Crawford belonged to, insisted that the DOE clean up its mess. And beginning in the early 90s, that was the focus. A lot of the existing employees were actually able to continue working there, though in different capacities. Bob Kispert, the man who didn't want to be grilled in my interview with him, had retired before this turnabout, but came back to help manage the cleanup.
Very few people had the site knowledge and the history of materials processed in the plants. So there were a lot of newer people coming in that needed some guidance.
Okay.
And could answer questions.
Stakeholders had to decide how the land should be used. The DOE, which had started being far more transparent in its dealings, empaneled a citizens' advisory board to weigh the options. It was a complicated decision, Graham Mitchell said.
Because you know, if it's going to be an industrial site, if it's going to be a recreational site, if you're going to build houses on it, those would all result in different cleanup levels.
Lisa Crawford was on the committee. The group weighed whether to clean to what's called background, meaning that the land would be scrubbed so thoroughly that houses could be built there someday. But that was just too expensive to realistically consider. As a parent, Lisa's first thought was what most mothers would be. Get all of this waste out of here. But that didn't feel right.
I don't want to be a NIMBY. You know, people back then were like, "What's a NIMBY? Not in my backyard." We didn't want to be looked upon as NIMBYs. So we made the tough, hard decisions to keep what we could keep and send the really bad stuff off-site.
Where did it end up going?
Some of the waste went to Utah. The name has evaded me, but it ain't called that anymore anyway. You know, they changed their name like they changed their underwear. Some of it went to Nevada Test Site, and then the really bad K-65 stuff went to WCS in Texas.
Yeah. Is that the one that's connected to the bushes?
Yeah. WCS stands for Waste Control Specialists, which is a controversial Houston-based company specializing in treating, storing, and disposing radioactive and hazardous waste. It was co-owned by a billionaire named Harold Simmons, who donated tens of thousands of dollars to George W. Bush when he was Texas governor. Simmons gave $2.5 million to Bush-allied organizations when W. ran for president, and he pledged $1 million to Bush's presidential library. When Simmons died in 2013, NPR reported he had donated more than $20 million to the GOP in the previous 9 years. The reason all that money matters is because Texas state law had prohibited private companies from running nuclear waste dumps. But after Simmons' wave of generosity, a lobbyist for Bush visited the Texas Natural Resource Conservation Commission and, long story short, the law was changed in 2003. Now, the Fernald Advisory Board asked that its land go back to nature. The dangerous waste that remained would be contained, the building footprints would be turned into ponds, the water would be tested for the foreseeable future. But they also wanted its past to be acknowledged somehow. And that's how it became what it is today, a nature preserve that houses a visitor center documenting the site's dirty history. The walls of the visitor center are lined with photos and memorabilia. Bob Kispert has a quote on the wall. We talked with two full-time workers stationed there, Sue Smiley, the DOE's Office of Legacy Management site manager, and Penny Borgman, who works for a contractor. Both were refreshingly forthcoming about the mistakes of the past. Here's Borgman.
The way I look at it, you know, it's obviously a healing process on the land, but it's also a healing process in the community. So we welcome anybody who, you know, is burdened by anger, hurt, whatever could have, you know, happened in the past.
I'd mentioned in an earlier episode that residents have access to medical monitoring. That was offered to people living within a 5-mile radius of the plant when it was operational. The monitoring largely stopped in 2008, though data is still collected. Workers can be monitored for life. A study at the University of Cincinnati found that the monitoring program has helped catch cancers early enough to better the mortality odds. The cleanup ultimately cost nearly $4.5 billion. It's a staggering amount, especially to David Bach's family, who at first had only wanted death benefits.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And now back to our story. The people who know Fernald best seem to be content with how things are now, but the post-shuttering hasn't been without hiccups. One of the companies handling the cleanup effort was found to have mismanaged things in the 1990s, And because it seems the site is cursed to have safety problems no matter what, the company also ignored warnings about looming equipment failures, which ultimately did fail and cause significant damage. More recently, a local TV journalist named Wayne Pullman reported that more than 500 pounds of radioactive uranium flowed from the site to the Great Miami River in 2017 alone. Since 2007, some 3.3 tons of uranium have been dumped into the river. That's because that while the water is constantly tested, it's only filtered when the uranium content is high enough to trigger treatment. It costs too much money to continuously filter the water, so it's sometimes done just a dozen days a year. Here's an analogy. Let's say you have 5 loads of laundry to do today, and you're only given 1 tub of water to do it. When each load is done, you run a test to see if the water you just used is super dirty and needs filtering before it gets put back into the tub, or if it's only slightly dirty and doesn't trigger the need for filtering. Even though the latter batch of water isn't awful, it isn't totally clean either. This is akin to how the groundwater at Fernald is tested, but instead of that slightly dirty water being run through your clothes, it's being dumped into the river. All of that slight contamination adds up, and in 2017, it added up to 500 pounds. A site contractor confirmed the releases to Pullman, but insisted the water is safe by EPA standards. Soon after this story ran, another broke about a middle school in Portsmouth, Ohio, the site of another nuclear facility, being closed after enriched uranium was detected inside the school. The school's a few miles from where the plant once stood, and that plant stopped operations in 2001. Uranium is tough to get rid of. That's why Fernald today is designated a Superfund site. There are more than 1,300 nationwide, 54 in Ohio alone. It's a federal designation given to land that's been contaminated by hazardous waste and is considered a risk to human health. As Mitchell explains,
but what happens at Superfund sites now is that there are always 5-year reviews. So every 5 years, there's a Ohio EPA and US EPA get together and with DOE and go over, you know, is the remedy still working? Is there, you know, all the remedies that we put in place out there, are they still working? Are they still protective? Have any laws or any rules or regulations changed that would make them not protective? You know, like a change in the drinking water standard for uranium or something like that. So all that review, it's a pretty big deal. So every site has to go through that. Every Superfund site has to go through these 5-year reviews. It's a pretty good process.
Amanda Rossman, my producer, had mentioned to me recently a story she'd read about deregulation. I think that's what prompted her to ask,
can it be sold off?
You're raising a great question for these sites because, you know, how long do governments last and how long do institutions last? And so, the rules right now say that it has to stay in the federal government's ownership in perpetuity.
But if somehow, someday, the history is lost and houses are built there, well, that would lead to a whole new set of parents feeling betrayed and scared for their children. David Box's family kept tabs on the headlines over the years. Casey Box, his daughter, had a tough time envisioning the land ever being properly cleaned up. So when the site was open to the public to show off the cleanup progress, she couldn't resist visiting. This was in the 90s. She went with her mother and her grandmother.
Well, when we got there, I went up to somebody and was talking to them. They were an employee and asked them how long they had worked there, and I told him who I was, and he kind of looked at me, and I told him my dad was and all that stuff, and he kind of cut the conversation off there, and, you know, well, nice to meet you, blah, blah, blah. I noticed the rest of the day that somebody, he went one way, I went the other, but I had noticed somebody was following me throughout the whole tour of their facility. It wasn't the same person, but it was somebody. But yeah, this person followed me all the way until I'd left. So they knew who I was. It was just too weird.
Strangely, it seems Bob Kispert remembers this visit as well, though it's Carlene, Casey's mom and David's ex-wife, whom he noticed.
But we had a display of the different plants, and she kept focused on the one. So when there was a little break with what I was doing, I went over and I gave her time and asked her if I could answer any of her questions. And she asked whether that was plant six. And I said yes, and I explained a little what went on. And she simply said, "I'm Miss Dave Bach's widow." Well, it hit me between the eyes because you don't expect that. So she just wanted to look at the pictures where the operation was done, where he went into the salt bath.
Carlene died suddenly in a farming accident in 2000. She had fought for answers for her children. She'd filed several lawsuits and given depositions. She and David had divorced, sure, but they'd been kids together, and they'd had kids together. That kind of connection doesn't always end just because the relationship does. Over the decades, David's three children have trouble explaining just how their dad's death has weighed on them over the decades. When you lose a parent young, it's like losing your footing in life. Each has had a rough run dealing with emotional and substance issues. Tony, the oldest, is open about the alcoholism he battled, just like his father did. But that wasn't his only struggle.
At least throughout my 20s and early 30s, I was a very, very, very bitter person. I self-medicated with alcohol severely and didn't really stop drinking until my 40s. And today, from my self-medication, I learned through the therapy that you self-medicate over depression.
Just as it's tough to know whether Fernald employees would have fallen sick had they not worked at the plant, David's kids can't know if their lives would have been less tumultuous had he lived. As I said earlier, nothing happens in a vacuum. After David died, the hits kept coming for them. If you look up the Unsolved Mysteries where Casey's interviewed, you don't just see a younger version of herself. You see a more open, less traumatized person than the one you meet today.
You know, my mom was killed in her front yard in a farming accident. The list can go on and on
and on.
And
the uncle.
I mean, and my uncle being hit by a car up on 28, you know, and just a number of things that have happened. And people are like, why is she so standoffish? Because I hate people. I despise people, you know. I don't want to get to know anybody. And until I had one lady, why are you so bitter? You really? You want me to give you a list? So I started listing stuff off, and they're like, okay, I'm sorry I asked. I'd be bitter too. You know, and it's, but, you know, you just do what you got to do and move on.
Don't be too fooled by her talk, though. Like a lot of tough people, you sense she's got a soft inside. Maybe a little too soft. Maybe that's why she's forged such a hard outer shell. She's funny, too, in this dry Stephen Wright kind of way. One of my favorite moments in our interviews was her reaction to noise outside of our meeting room at a local library.
My fiancé will tell people, you know, occasionally about it, or somebody will see the Unsolved Mysteries and be like, I think I saw you.
I'm sorry, okay. There is a child screaming outside of the door. Okay, yeah. Go ahead.
But, you know, or somebody will see the Unsolved Mysteries and say, was that you? You know, yeah. And then, or they'll, I'm not much for people. And it's only
because of that outside the door?
That's one of the reasons. But the things that I've gone through in my life, I mean, my dad was the tip of the iceberg.
I'm sorry. Good.
Sorry. I see why some animal kingdoms eat their young.
Amanda and I were careful not to get hopes up as we investigated this case. We learned from season one that we can find all sorts of avenues to pursue, and police can sound like they're ready to pursue them. But that doesn't mean they will. I can't tell you for sure where the Beth Andes investigation stands, because the most police say now is that they're working on it, whatever that means. When we took on this case, our goal was to find new avenues, sure, but it was also to just give this case an open mind and the time it deserved. David's kids lost their father, a man they loved, a man who shaped them. Our goal was to simply give this case proper attention, and we did that, but as we neared the end, we realized that wouldn't be enough. When we talked with Detective Alderucci, he at one point said, "Hey, if there's something new to pursue, it should be pursued." He also said he wouldn't be the guy to do it because he's retired. So we reached out to his former department to see if anyone there would be willing to sit with us and learn what we found. That's how we got connected with a major named Bill Rarick.
This is your last chance to save 65% on a full year of BODi. I'm Carl, co-founder of BODi. That's B-O-D-I. And I want to help you lean into your decision to start working out and eating better. Right now, if you sign up for a one-year subscription to BODi, I'll give you 65% off. Look, I know it's not easy to get fit and lose weight, especially if you're trying to figure it out by yourself. But we make it simple. Just follow a program for 20 to 30 minutes day by day and lose 5 to 10 pounds a month. We have over 120 programs that have been tested and proven to work, and almost 300,000 five-star reviews in the App Store to prove it. BODi also has complete eating plans and thousands of healthy, delicious recipes. So stop guessing and start seeing results with BODi. And let me give you 65% off right now so you save big on the app that CNN underscored named Best Fitness App. But the sale ends this week, so don't wait. Sign up for a year of BODi and save 65%. Just go to BODi.com. That's B-O-D-I with an I.com.
With everyone fighting for attention, how can your business stand out and connect with customers? Easy. Get Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketing platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. Constant Contact makes it easy to promote your business with powerful tools like email and SMS marketing, social media posting, and even events management. Don't know much about marketing? No sweat. Constant Contact's writing assistance tools and automation features help you say the right thing at the right time, every time. Tackle any challenge with Constant Contact's expert live customer support. Plus, everything's backed by their 30-day money-back guarantee. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact. Helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
And now back to our story. On a gray, rainy morning in early November, Amanda and I met at the newsroom and headed a mile to the Hamilton County Sheriff's Office.
What should we lead with?
Hey.
I mean, after that.
Thanks for meeting with us.
Have you given this any thought?
It was a strange meeting to prepare for because it's odd for journalists to share what they found with law enforcement. And this felt odder still. We knew the department already had adopted the suicide theory. And while we don't really see that as being plausible, we'd never say it's impossible. We try to keep the blinders off. Still, because that's the official department thinking, we figured we should focus on the unpursued angles with extra vigor.
I usually don't try to argue a case.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like counterintuitive to me. So, but they're already going to be so biased toward
the
original investigation, yeah. That I feel like we have to kind of at least be enthusiastic or explain with some amount of
why we think it should be looked into.
Yeah, just looked into.
The sheriff's office is in a sort of complex on Sycamore Street in Cincinnati near the county jail. It's nestled among mom and pop diners and bail bondsmen. After we went inside, we had to go through security.
Okay.
Rarick and I had talked briefly on the phone, but this was our first time meeting in person.
Hey, we're media, but we're here for something else. We're here to see Bill O'Rourke.
Oh, okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and have a seat? And okay. I'll stay up. I'll come on up. Thank you.
You're here for...
Bill?
That's
right. Oh, hi. Nice to meet you.
Hi. Nice to meet you.
I'm Amanda.
Nice to meet you.
If you'd like. You're going in the conference room?
Yes.
He said he wanted to hear us out, but he asked us not to record our meeting, mostly because he didn't know us. I suspect he might have thought we were there to capture some kind of gotcha moment, but the truth is, we don't hold out hope that any detective will have time to listen to some 7 hours of podcast chronicling our year-long investigation. So we wanted to meet in person and synthesize things in hopes of piquing someone's interest enough to take seriously the possibilities we're presenting. We agreed to click off the recorder so everyone could feel comfortable speaking freely. Rarick brought to our meeting Captain Tony Orrue, who heads investigations. I had forwarded Rarick the public files I'd used, and it was clear he had taken a few days to familiarize himself with this case from before his time. Amanda and I laid everything out, the whistleblowing theory, the reason we're not sure suicide makes sense, the reports of drug sales at Fernald, and the inconsistencies in certain witness testimony. Both detectives were guarded in how they responded, which is no surprise. It's an interview technique, one that most journalists use too. You learn to minimize your reaction so you don't lead the subject in any particular direction. We were careful to say we don't think Alderucci was lazy or malicious. We have reason to believe he's a good detective. But good doesn't mean infallible, nor should it. Everyone can be wrong. The points we emphasized were these. That David got someone suspended, but that person wasn't asked his whereabouts or questioned critically beyond discerning that it likely wasn't his motorcycle spotted by a coworker the morning of David's death. That, despite said coworker finding a motorcycle's presence unusual enough to report, no one bothered pinning down whose cycle it was. That suicide seemed highly improbable given the size of the vat's opening. That investigator's insistence that no one could have put David in the vat seems bizarrely intractable given that employees who knew that vat far better deem it possible. That Charlie Schaus was the only person to ever say David seemed despondent, and yet he for some reason told investigators that Harry agreed with him when he didn't. That no one investigated Schaus, despite him having put himself with the dead man at the time of death. The two push back here and there. For example, Orrue said, if workers knew the vat as well as it seemed, wouldn't they have known it wasn't a perfect place to get rid of evidence? Wouldn't they know all about the melting point of various metals and that bits of bone might survive? Maybe, we said. But then again, they would typically just put two items in that vat, fruit and uranium ingots. It's possible they didn't think about metal eyelets and steel-toed boots. If you're in a hurry to dispose of a body, you might take what you can get. When I said 10 minutes was an awfully long time for Schaus to have talked with David to try and get him to open up, as he told detectives initially, Rarick strategically shrugged. Maybe Schaus was wrong on the time. Maybe it was only 5 minutes. Still, I said, 5 minutes is a long while to ignore somebody's questions. Wouldn't that have felt like an eternity to Schaus, standing there asking questions of a man who wouldn't reply? Did it bother him that after this one-sided conversation, David immediately would have strolled into Plant 6 to dive into a vat of molten salt? There's no right way to respond to trauma, but if you apply a tiny bit of common sense and human nature to this scenario, something seems off. It's possible there's an easy explanation, but man, it'd be nice if somebody bothered to ask. After the meeting, Amanda and I chatted in her car.
How'd it go?
I was really nervous at first. Like, dude, I felt like was stonewalling us right from the beginning.
Yeah.
And then it got better.
Yeah, he you know what he was doing? He does this thing I do in my interviews where, you know, he's holding back and he's just trying to listen and he doesn't want to tip his hand at all. But then he said a few things during where he was like, well, yeah, that doesn't make sense.
Right. So I definitely felt better about that. It's hard to read.
Yeah.
But I feel...
I feel heard.
Yeah, I do feel like we were heard.
Just as we try not to raise false hope with victims' families, Oru and Rarick tried to temper our expectations too. This case is very old, after all, so the necessary pieces might be missing to do anything about it now. Still, the last thing they told us was that they were intrigued and willing to reopen the case. Amanda asked if that was something we could tell David's kids. Sure, they said. Pass along our info and let people know they can reach out to us with tips. Later that day, we called Tony.
The reason we wanted to talk is because we wanted to let you know, we thought it was important to tell you rather than you learn it from the podcast. We have brought what we found to the sheriff's department. And they listened. And they said, I'm being very cautious here because I don't want, you know, any false hope, but they said they're reopening the case.
Wow. So, thank you so much. I could almost cry.
There's something about your parents. No matter whether they were good or bad or around or not, their early impressions on you never really go away. Tony is 53 now. When we met for our first interview, he said something interesting.
He was 42, 43 years old when he died. Near 43. You know?
No, he was 39.
39?
Yeah.
Gosh.
Tony's now nearly a decade and a half older than his dad ever reached. And yet, when he thinks about him, he sees a man bigger, older, wiser than he is.
I still look up to him like he's my dad, you know? And my last memories of him, I'm still thinking of him as my dad, and I'm 53. It's been every day I think of him too, every single day.
We never stop being our parents' children. We never stop looking up to them, even after we figured out that they weren't magical, all-knowing beings, but rather just people doing their best to get by, same as we are now that we're grown up too. Not long after we talked, Tony sent a text. After we hung up, he did have a cry. It was like a pressure valve had been loosened on 35 years worth of frustration and anger and bitterness that had built. He knows finding the concrete, irrefutable truth is still a long shot, but that someone listened, that they're willing to try, that's worth a lot to a family whose suspicions have been ridiculed for decades. Amanda, Phil, and I have been back and forth to the Fernald Preserve probably a half a dozen times over the past year. We've walked some trails and trailed some geese and watched the sunset turn the cattails a beautiful golden hue. It's peaceful there, but once you know the story of the place, it can be tough to block it out. At the end of the drive, not far past the spot where a historical marker stands today, was once a guardhouse where armed men kept curious visitors at bay. Those beautiful ponds were once the foundations of filthy, contaminated buildings. Beneath the earth, radioactive waste remains encased in concrete. There's little left outside of the visitor center to help you visualize the way things were before. It's tough to orient yourself even to figure out where Plant 6 stood when David met his fate there. I can't quite calm the unease I feel when I visit, an unease that comes from knowing the dark history of such a serene-looking place. And that's probably a good thing. That history shouldn't be forgotten, not the history of the plant, nor of David himself. People died on this land and for this cause. Lies were told to keep secret the dark truths hidden here. David Box died here. And the people tasked with figuring out why were content to dismiss it as a mystery never to be solved. When a tragedy occurs, we don't always find a clear answer. That's just how the real world works. But that doesn't mean it's okay to slap a convenient explanation onto it and walk away, hoping that everyone forgets. It's like using a Band-Aid to cover a bullet wound. It's not a fix. The problem is still there, festering. We can't forget what happened at Fernald just because the people in charge muddied the waters so much that sifting the lies from the truth is near impossible. No matter why David died there, the fact is he did. And for some reason, all the avenues to figure out why weren't explored. He deserves to be remembered, not as an urban legend, but as a father. He deserves it, but the rest of Fernald demands to be remembered, because if it isn't, if its history is somehow forgotten, someone someday will unwittingly reopen the earth there and unleash some deadly secrets. To binge this season, go to www.wondery.com/plus. That's WONDERY.com/PLUS. To support the creators of Accused directly, go to our Patreon page where donors get bonus content and early episodes. That's at patreon.com/accused. This is a special project from the Cincinnati Enquirer, part of the USA Today network, narrated by Amber Hunt, produced by Amanda Rossman, engineered by Phil Didion, and edited by Amy Wilson. Intern Mark Rosenberg provided additional research. Music was composed by Andrew Higley. To look at case documents, photos, videos, and more, visit accusedpodcast.com. As noted, some audio comes from a Living History project from the Fernald Community Alliance. Transcripts to those interviews are available at fernaldcommunityalliance.org.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.